Today is the 7th of Iyar, May 7th, 5774, and we're doing mitzvot 408 to 410. Let's see. So these are the mitzvahs of setting up the Levite city. So we saw one earlier. I'll tell you what number that is. I didn't write it down. 342. That's the one about leaving the fields open around their cities, that you're not allowed to sell the fields. So we saw that earlier, and we're going to see in the future, number 520. So there's really a few mitzvahs together, but we're going to look at these three today. So the first one is to give the Levites cities to dwell in and to give refuge to the unintentional manslayer. It's interesting that these are two together, and I'm not quite sure. It doesn't seem to be
holy and profane.
Well, it's not that it's holy and profane. It's that it's two things. How are two things one mitzvah?
Yeah, but we've seen that before, two things one mitzvah.
Not too many times.
But we have seen it before. I can't quote it.
Not too many times, right. So here's the mitzvah. The mitzvah is to give the Levite cities to dwell in, really. That's the idea.
These were not the same area, were they, where the Levites lived in the unintentional...
The same.
They were in the same space?
Yes. Yes. So that's what we're going to look at.
A refuge city is the Levite city.
Well, so there are six refuge cities that are mandated by the Torah and 42 Levitical cities.
Okay.
Nevertheless, Levites live in the refuge cities and all the Levitical cities are refuge cities as well.
Okay.
So they're a crossover. So there's 48 cities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting that they go together. Also, we'll see how they go together, okay? Mm-hmm. So the mitzvah is that the Israelites were commanded to give the tribe of Levi cities to dwell in, since they had no share in the land. For it is stated, command the Israelites that they shall give to the Levites from the inheritance of their possession cities to dwell in. So number one, we have to ask what's going on here. When they're handing out the land, when God's handing out the land, why doesn't he just give cities to the Levium? Why does he give the land to all the other 11 tribes and then tell each tribe, you have to give from your land to the Levites to live?
Well, just like Truma.
Yeah, it is like that.
Yeah.
Right? You have your produce and you have to give some. But here's land. So it's not an annual thing. This is a one-time thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So why do you make it so that the Jews have to give from what they have to somebody else? So it is like the Truma in that we have to understand we need to support our Torah teachers. That's what the whole tribe of Levi is about, teaching Torah, making things happen. Kohanim are included in the tribe of Levi.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to know, not only do we have to give them food to sustain them, we have to give them everything as much as we possibly can, a whole city to live in. That's important. We need to sustain them so that we have to take care of our Levium. So it does have to come from what's ours to give to them. So that's reason number one. There's a second reason which we'll talk about. But, yeah.
Still, why is it a separate city? Why can't just Levites live among the others?
Great. That's a very good question. Why can't they? That's interesting to think about it from... now I'm thinking about it from a different angle. Initially, you have the whole land. You could ask that question about the whole land. Why is land divided into tribes? What's up with that? Why can't the Jews just all live together? Seems that we have problems doing that. Anyway, so maybe the Torah recognized that as tiny as we are, we need to have our own little chunks and pieces. Anyway, we did have separate a chunk of land for each tribe, so we lived separately. So amongst that, the Levites' portion was their separate cities.
Mm-hmm.
You'd think, though, because of what we're going to learn in a minute, that you'd like to see them sprinkled around. Maybe, though, sprinkling them around would dilute their strength.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible. Because let's just hold that for a minute, and then we'll look at this and add that back in, okay? Among these cities of the Levites, some of them were cities specifically designated to be places of refuge for an inadvertent killer, although he could find refuge in all of them. So six were particularly set aside for that refuge cities, but all of them are refuge for the inadvertent killer. And so to Shoftim and the precept of the cities of refuge, we will write with the Eternal Lord's help what difference there was between those especially designated and the other ones. They would provide refuge for him under certain known circumstances as explained in Scripture and clarified in the Tractate Makot. Okay, so we're not going to look at that yet, the differences between the two, because I don't know it yet. But so there it does seem to be a difference. Nevertheless, all the cities provide refuge. So let's look at the root reasons and then go back. So this is interesting root reason. As for the root reason of this precept, It is known that the tribe of Levi was the chosen one of the tribes, prepared for service in the temple of the Lord, and it had no share with the Israelites in the inheritance of fields and vineyards, but cities they needed in any event to dwell in them, they, their sons and infants, and all their livestock. And because of the greatness of their nobility and worthiness of their activity and the grace of their distinction, their territory was chosen to give refuge to anyone who kills a living soul inadvertently, rather than the grounds of the other tribes. Perhaps their land, hallowed by their holiness, would effect atonement for him. So here's to the two reasons, right? So first reason is they don't have a place to live. They need a place to live. We have to give them a place to live. But second is about the second part of it, that it's refuge. So it's possible that the reason why those are the refuge cities is because it is a concentration of holy people. And in that concentration of holy people, hopefully that's going to create an effect and atonement for that person. So it's a rehabilitation system. We don't send that person to prison. They killed it inadvertently. A person who kills on purpose, they have to get killed. But a person who kills by mistake, they did something wrong that allowed that mistake. They weren't paying attention. Somehow, we do believe in hashgacha, you know, that God runs the world. That person needed to die. But did I need to be the one who killed him? Right? Why was that channeled through me? Could only be channeled through me if I have something frazzled in my channeling capability, that I needed to channel something so negative, or that I could possibly channel something so negative. If I would be all functioning correctly, I would not have channeled that death. So therefore, I need to go to a place where I can be healed from what I did. So, and there's lots of different things. There's atonements that need to happen. So part of the atonement is exile, is being away. So we'll talk about that in another mitzvah shortly. But here we have the concentration of the Levi'im creating an environment in which a person can best be rehabilitated. So that's rehabilitated because they watch their actions and they see how they behave, but also because the kedusha, the holiness that this group of people generates, should hopefully create an environment that allows the person to effect atonement. So it's both by witnessing their behavior and by living, just breathing the air of kedusha. So, and we understand that. We see different, you know, environments in which people live and how that affects them. So we want to send this person who did something bad to an environment that's good, as opposed to what we do in this country, let's say, send somebody who did something bad to an environment where they're going to learn worse, right? And we send them to prison, and they come out completely educated and everything they need to know to continue a life of crime and misery. Imagine if instead of sending, what are they called, criminals, to prison, we'd send them to convents or something like that, right? One per place, so they'd have a chance to, you know, live, or to yeshiva, one per yeshiva. So they have a chance to live with people who are engaged in holy pursuit. But you need a concentration for that to work. It can't be around one family. So that could be one reason why there needs to be separate cities for Levi'im. Because if you sprinkle them throughout the population, so on the one hand, if you sprinkle them throughout the population, that's good. Many people have neighbors who are Levi'im. On the other hand, it dilutes their kedusha-generating power, or at least the ability to perceive it and see it, that hopefully those cities run very differently than other cities, and you can obviously tell, you know.
I found it.
Yeah?
It's Mitzvah 384, the precept of sounding trumpets at the sanctuary and in battle. And I have notes here that was two mitzvahs in one.
Uh-huh. Good for you. Good for you.
Yes. So we've seen this before.
Good.
This
good.
Phenomenon.
Shkoyach. Shkoyach. Excellent. Good job.
Thank you.
Good job. Yeah. That's good. I didn't daven properly. You know, usually I daven that I should learn Torah, understand Torah, remember the Torah. Live the Torah, teach the Torah. I forgot to say that tefillah today, so I didn't remember. That's good then.
You do really well enough, even without praying.
An inadvertent killer stay there for the rest of his life.
Okay, so yes. So this is not for the rest of their life, for the rest of the life of the Kohen Gadol.
Mm.
That's how long the sentence is.
The term is for life.
The term is for the life of the Kohen Gadol, which might be the life of the person. If it's the life of the person, then they're buried in that city and can't be buried somewhere else until the Kohen Gadol dies, when they can be disinterred and buried in their family plot. But they have to stay in that city, dead or alive, until the Kohen Gadol dies. So that could be 2 months. It could be 40 years, depending on, you know, whatever. Tiny to a lot, depending on the lifespan of the Kohen Gadol.
So the whole reason why these people, well, not only because of the rehabilitation, but also for their own safety, right?
Yes.
So that the relatives of the person murdered or killed inadvertently will not revenge.
Right, which they're permitted to do. They're permitted to take revenge and kill him. Mm-hmm. Right, so it's not just an act of anger. They are permitted, so that is, they're permitted to do it, and the safety zone is the Levitical city, the city of refuge.
Okay.
So that's where that's home base.
But after
if they step out,
dies,
then they're
safe. Returns,
then they're no longer permitted to kill him.
They're no longer permitted to kill him.
No. Then that wipes away. Right. So now the halacha discusses three types of inadvertent killers. It's called a shogeg. A shogeg is somebody who does something inadvertently. Anyway, the two words, the vocabulary words here are shogeg and mazid. So shogeg is inadvertent. That's for any sin. Shogeg. You know, you might keep carefully kosher and not eat bugs, but you didn't see that one in the lettuce in your hamburger and you ate it. You ate it for shogeg. That's totally different than saying, I could care less about checking my lettuce. I never check it. And then you ate it b'mezid. Right? Shogeg and mezid. So people...
Mezid.
With a dalad. A D. Mezid. So, shogeg. So there's three types of shogeg killers. There's shogeg regular old. They did it by mistake, right? They were backing up their car, and they ran over somebody they just didn't see, right? Then there's shogeg close to mazid, right? They were reckless. They were backing up their car while they were texting, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't check. That's pretty close to on purpose. It's not on purpose. It's still shogeg, but it's pretty close to on purpose. Didn't have the kavana to kill, but they were so negligent that you can't call that 100% mistake. That wasn't. They crossed the line there. But still, that was shogeg. And the third one is shogeg close to forced. I'm trying to think of an example of that.
So it's like meditative, maybe?
No, close to forced. If you're forced into it. Like,
they attack you and you
kill them. That's self-defense. I don't know. Let's just say, you're driving at the speed limit, but it's icy. And you didn't realize there's a patch of black ice. You're going down the hill. You're going the speed limit, driving safely, not texting, nothing. You put on your brakes, but your car skids. And you can't stop it no matter what. And you hit somebody. Right? So you're doing everything right. But you hit somebody and killed somebody. But you were like the ice forced you into it. You did everything you could not to. You saw it. You tried to stop it. You were following all the rules. But you were forced into it. That's a different kind of shogeg.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So somebody... Let me see if I... What did I write down here? I'm pretty sure... That somebody, for sure somebody who's forced altogether. You know, if somebody comes up to you and somebody hits you from behind and causes you to hit the person, so you are forced into killing them, then you don't have to go to a city of refuge. You're completely innocent. I'm not sure about somebody who's shogeg karov la'ones, somebody who's close to ones. They might not have to go to a city of refuge. They might be covered. They might be safe to stay in regular society. Somebody who did it by mistake but was close to on purpose, that person who was texting, not paying attention at all, they aren't allowed to go into a city of refuge. They just have to be careful.
Ooh.
Yeah.
To watch.
They just have to watch their back.
Night.
That's right. They do. They just have to watch out.
Yeah.
They don't merit to go to a city of refuge. But the person who did it by mistake does merit to go to a city of refuge. It was a mistake. They didn't mean it. But still, they maybe should have been more careful than they were. They weren't forced.
Well, where are the courts? I mean, you know, if
right, so
my
courts,
ox scores your ox, right. Or, you know, an eye for an eye. I mean, why can't this person go to the bait den? And say,
yeah, I think they do.
Okay.
I think in a case, I mean, it could be that that person who was texting is now, you know, sees the relatives chasing him. He runs to the city of refuge. They can't touch him. Maybe the courts are now going to rule. You can't stay here. Hmm. You have no right to be here. Right? So... Or the person who was pushed from behind but didn't know the halacha, and now that person's dead and they run to the city of refuge, then they can rule. You know, you don't have to stay here. You're safe.
So does the other family know that?
Yeah, and then they would, I mean, I don't know exactly how it worked.
Yeah.
Because there is a court system, which we're going to see in the next halacha. There is a court system that does have to be utilized. So that's the basic thing of the cities of refuge. So the Levium live there. It's their inheritance. And it also is a place of refuge for somebody who kills inadvertently, who doesn't have the intent.
Would these laws ever come back into use?
So apparently, it's interesting, and in a way this is a little bit dejecting, but the question is, there's a question, is 48 cities enough for Levium? I mean, it might be enough when they first handed them out, but... What about if the population grows? Can you have more? Do you just expand those cities, or do you increase the number of cities? Does it have to be that number of cities, or can, you know, how do you accommodate population growth is a question not answered, not clear. But it is clear that in the times of Mashiach, there will be three more refuge cities. And maybe they'll just be set up. So the question is, what will these refuge cities be? We don't have any right now. I mean, they're not designated right now. There'll be three more. Three more than nothing? Three more than the six? Are the six going to be functioning and we're going to add three more? To me, on the one hand, okay, that's nice. So we know what's going to happen when Mashiach comes. We're going to have three more. On the other hand, what do we need three more for? Three more is to accommodate more inadvertent killers. How sad is it that even during Mashiach time, there's going to be people who are in bad enough spiritual shape that they're still killing inadvertently, that we need nine cities of refuge to accommodate them?
But these would also be for Levium?
Also for Levium, but the point is more cities of Miklat. We're going to have three, we're going to add to the number, because what we're going to have before is not going to be enough. So, I don't know. Those are just questions I had. He didn't discuss at length, you know, Rabbi Rosner, and hearing these extra things. He's so great. He prepares so nicely.
Can you tell us the cities?
No.
No, can you tell us, you know, I know that Shiloh is one of them, and isn't Beersheba? I mean, it shows in the Bible which ones are the refuge cities.
We should probably have
The old listed in the
Torah. Yeah, they're all there.
We should have the Living Bible.
In Genesis,
Arya Kaplan would have
pictures of
that.
It lists the six, you know, and actually those six cities were the
six,
places
the
where Abraham set up his altars originally.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It's in the text itself, in the Torah.
Yeah, there's a map. I mean, it's in my art scroll. You know, maybe I can Google it, but it's so interesting to know what these six cities are.
Let's
see if I can find it.
I have the Hertz, but that's probably, this is not a mappy one.
So where it's in.
Just put it, look in six.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to do.
Phones are amazing, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. What did we do with that? We drove ourselves crazy. 3 weeks later, we know what it is.
So we're still driving ourselves crazy with them.
Okay, so let's see. The six cities are... six cities. It just comes out. Let's see what that is. Talk amongst yourselves.
Yeah.
This thing is loading. It may be a little bit. Here we go.
This reminds me of a story that Rabbi Bolel told me in Des Moines. So he said he was talking to the Reform rabbi who said to him, somebody came to him and asked him if we know what type of wood Aaron's staff was made out of. And so he said, no, we don't really know. And I gave him a whole little drush on, you know, I made up something for him. So Rabbi Bolel looked at him and said, we do know what kind of wood it was made out of. It was made out of almond. So the Reform rabbi looks at him and says, what is that, a midrash? He says, actually, no, that's the text. And he opened up the Chumash and showed him the exact verse where it says, almond wood.
Okay, so here are the cities of refuge. Starting in the south, Hebron. Bezer, which is to Bezer, the north of the Dead Sea, Shechem, Ramot Gilead, Golan, and Kodesh in the north.
Huh. And those are, it's big circles. How come the circles are so big? I wonder if the entire area...
There was another one, too.
What's after Ramot Gilead?
Let's see. So it's Golan and Kadesh.
Golan.
Yeah, so it's... So you have... What this one says Hebron. I said Hebron, right? Hebron, yeah. Bezer, Shechem, Ramot Gilead, Golan, and Kadesh.
So we don't have all those cities today. But what I was wondering is this.
That one?
Why the circles are so big. Oh, because the... I see.
Oh, just images.
No, I think it's to... No, because... See, go back to the circles.
All right.
Because here it says approximately 1 day's journey. So you want to show that the land is mostly covered, that you would be safe in many places. Because you have to get to those cities.
Right, here. So here's a picture of it. So, walk in. Yeah, here they're spread out geographically.
I'll be darned, it shows you where they are.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Oh, I thought Shiloh was one. I guess it's not. But anyway.
Shechem.
That's
where the tablets were, right?
No, Shiloh is where the tablets are.
Oh, okay. Shechem is where Dino was raised.
Right.
Yeah. And that's an Arab city today.
His brothers?
Most of these are Arab cities. Hebron, Shechem.
Hebron was also a Jewish city. There were Jews living there.
Hebron's a Jewish city, but it's mostly Arabs living there.
Yeah,
but it's mostly Arabs living there. It's only brave and defiant Jews living there.
Bezer, I've never heard of Bezer.
Yeah, me either.
Bezer, maybe it had another name.
Gilead.
Let's see. Maybe it had.
Still don't have one of them, but it's
fine. Okay, wait. So it's Hebron, Bezer.
Kodesh.
Shechem, Ramot Gilead, Golan, and Kadesh.
Golan is the strip.
Well, according to
north,
this it was at that time. Yeah, that Golan, time. Whatever that meant. And yeah.
Kadesh.
Kedesh. Kadesh.
All right. So let's read about how nice the Libyan
six refugees
came right up.
Amazing. It's really amazing.
Who fed all that?
So many people. Yeah. Okay, here, I just want to read this paragraph because we should know what our Levium, what we should be striving towards if we are Levium, what Levium should be like, or what they're described as here. There is, moreover, another reason for the matter. Since they were men, they, the Levium, were men of good heart, renowned for the eminent worth of their qualities and their noble wisdom, it was known to all that they would not detest the slayer who took refuge with them, and would not harm him, even if he killed one of their good friends, or avenging blood relations. Meaning, what if this killer killed one of the Levites who lives in that city?
They got
into the wrong Levite city, where the Goel Dam, a blood avenger, lives, is one of the Levium. Saying they're such good, the Levium are such good people that they would not kill him, since he killed him suddenly or accidentally without enmity. About this chosen tribe, it is stated, who said of his father and his mother, I have not seen him. So that's a verse in Deuteronomy 33:9. In other words, they would do nothing in the world that was not in accord with decency, attuned to the truth. And no affection for a man would sway their heart, not even love for a father and mother, brother and sons, whom human nature obligates, nay, compels one to love, and all the more certainly not for the love of any other human beings. I wrote further about the subject yet, another point of reason in the 11th negative precept of Behar 342, but the point is, these Levium were such good people that they just were not swayed by their emotions to take revenge on somebody. They never would. They behave in a way that's not subject to that. So it's just interesting to see. We should get there again, Bezrat Hashem. Okay, Mitzvah 409. Not to execute a guilty person who deserves death before he stands trial. Okay, so that sounds... So there's a mitzvah of due process. But what's really going on here? So let's say you see somebody sneak up behind somebody else with a knife and hack them, right? Now, you know they deserve death because that's how our Torah works, right? You kill somebody, you're going to get killed. That is the rule of law. And you warned him even, because you have to warn. There has to be witnesses and warning. So you're with your friend, who you're not related to, so you're two kosher, and you're male. Two kosher witnesses. You see the guy with the knife sneaking up. You say, wait, stop. If you kill that guy, you'll be transgressing the Avera of Lo Tirzach, of don't murder. And he turns and he says, I know. And then he hacks him, right? Now you could say, we saw it. Two witnesses. We warned him. He acknowledged it. He did it anyway. We can kill him. Right? We have a gun. Why bother schlepping him to the courts? Let's just kill him. Right? Not allowed to do that. Not to execute a guilty person. He's guilty. Who deserves death? He deserves it. Before he stands trial. He has to stand trial. Because we don't just kill somebody. Who knows what was the other part of that story? Mm-hmm. You know, who knows what was going on? And you don't know. You just saw one slice of it. The courts are going to want to find, they're going to want to look and look and look and dig up and see if they can find any way to exonerate him at all whatsoever. We don't want to kill somebody who's innocent or kill somebody who has mitigating circumstances. So we are going to bring him to trial. We are going to look and look. But we can't just kill him. And even if the whole Sanhedrin, who he's going to stand trial before, even if they were out together having a coffee break and the entire Sanhedrin witnessed it, then they can't serve as judges. They have to all serve as witnesses, and they have to find another court to try this in front of, who will be judges that didn't see it, and they can only be witnesses. So it has to be. We have to have due process.
Well, ideally, there has to be due process, but, you know, in the heat of the moment, the relatives of the slain person, you know, all things being equal, could just...
Yes, they could.
They could just kill them on the spot.
Now, I'm not sure what happens if in the heat of the moment it was the relatives, the goel dam, mm-hmm. who kills the person. That may be different than if you take justice into your own hands. You're from Texas. You say, I know what to do with guys like that. Right?
Self-deputize myself.
That's right. And you kill him,
yeah.
Right?
Right.
Because you decided. So that would make the person who makes that decision into a murderer. And they also have to stand trial.
Okay.
Nevertheless, in this same mitzvah, we are reminded that there is a time to take justice into our own hands and to kill somebody. And that's before they kill. So if you see that person sneaking up with a knife and you tell them, wait, stop, and they say no, and you have a gun, you're allowed to shoot him before he kills the person, not after. After they have to stand trial. Before, if they're sneaking up to kill that person, or if somebody's sneaking up to rape a woman, then and they won't stop, then you're permitted to kill them. They're called a rodef, and you're allowed to stop a rodef in their tracks by killing them if you need to.
Do you need to have some sort of defense mechanism, or
for yourself?
Yeah, right.
So that's just
a witness.
Do you have to have witnesses to this?
No.
So you're not liable to anything if you do this.
Right. Then there's going to be due process for that too. Let's see. Uh-huh. But if there, you can't be convicted for murder unless there are two witnesses who warn you correctly. So if there are those two witnesses, then they're clearly seeing that you're just saving the person, right?
But saving the other person.
Saving the other person, right? And if there aren't witnesses, there aren't witnesses. So you can't be convicted anyway. But let's see. Right. But if someone... Okay, so here it says, on 222, the bottom paragraph in the middle... But if someone was chasing after his fellow man to kill him, or after a betrothed maiden, and he was cautioned, yet did not desist from his pursuit, even if he did not accept the warning, we are duty-bound to kill him, and are so adjured about him, as we will write with the Eternal Lord's help toward the end of Sedra Kitetze about the injunction, then you shall cut off her hand, your eye shall have no pity. Mitzvah 601, which we'll get to at that point. But that there is a time to act right then without Beit Din if you're preventing that type of a sin from occurring. This precept applies to both men and women everywhere. If we are adjured not to kill any sinner, even if we've seen him doing an act which he will be sentenced to death at the Beit Din, and at the time the temple exists, we are duty-bound to bring him to the Beit Din, and they, the justices, will try him. If a person transgresses this and kills a sinner before he comes to the Beit Din, even if the law is that he should be found guilty by the Beit Din, The law for his slayer is as the law for any killer, and he is to be put to death for it at the time the temple stands, if there are witnesses. So you're not considered a slayer if you prevent it from happening, but you are considered a slayer if you take justice into your own hands and exact revenge or justice on the person who already killed. So that's this mitzvah 409, applying to both men and women. Okay, and now we can look at mitzvah 410, the duty of the court to make an unintentional killer go to a city of refuge, and his duty to go there. So it's a double thing. We have these cities of refuge. Are they optional? What if you say, I'll just take my chances. You know, I really don't want to leave my family. I don't want to leave my business. I don't want to leave my homeland, my, you know, home area. I don't want to go to a city of refuge. I don't know those people over there. They're too holy for me. I can't live with people like that, right? I'm just going to take my chances. Hopefully, it'll be okay. I'll learn Krav Maga, protect myself. I'll wear a vest, right? You can't. It's not an option. So it's the mitzvah of the Beit Din l'hashlich makah nefesh b'shkaga. They have to send him, that person who killed by mistake, from his city to the Ir Miklat. And it's also the mitzvah for the one who kills to go to that Ir Miklat. So both. He has to go, but if he doesn't go, then it's a mitzvah on the Beit Din to send him there, to force him to go there. So let's read what it says. Mitzvah 410, that a Beit Din of Israelites was commanded to cast out of his city a person who struck down someone inadvertently and place him in the cities of refuge, as it is stated. And the community shall restore him to his city of refuge, etc. And he shall live in it until the death of the Kohen Gadol. And the manslayer is equally included in this positive precept, for it is stated about him, because he must stay in his city of refuge until the death of the Kohen Gadol.
Did anyone ever kill the Kohen Gadol in order to...
Very good question. Very good question. So apparently the mother of the Kohen Gadol is supposed to make... it's her job to help take care of the slayers.
So the mother of the Kohen Gadol takes care of the slayers?
So that they won't daven for his death. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Because you don't want them...
How does she do that if they're living in this...
She has a little boarding house for them.
Yeah, no, I don't think she takes care. I think she sends them. I mean, I don't remember exactly. She sends them treats. She knits them sweaters. She makes them cookies. She sends them shalchmanis, whatever it is. But she has her, like, she takes care of them in some way so that they won't daven for his death. She tries to make them comfortable.
So is this a medrash or this?
It sounds like a great medrash.
I don't know if it's a medrash or if it's a halacha for her or an eitzah, an advice for her. Huh. Not one of the 613, but that is the process, that she does the extra caretaking of them so that they won't daven for her son's death. Yeah, because that is definitely a risk, right?
So if the Kohen Gadol has a mother living.
Right, and then who does it if she doesn't? Yeah, maybe his wife, his daughter, I don't know, sister.
But someone would take that.
Yeah, somebody takes on that. Yeah, so that'd be interesting to find out.
This would all come back if you had the Beis HaMikdash.
Yeah. Yeah, things would be very different. It's interesting just to think about how things change over the years.
It's hard to imagine.
It is very hard to imagine. Because we've really done so many different systems over the years. You know, things that we've absorbed from other countries or different ways of thinking about it, how we make it work. We certainly don't have anything like this today. All that's available to us as a Jewish community today is Beit Din. So we can find somebody, or we can judge that somebody owes the money, you know, if they're arguing. Or the most that we can do is put them in chayrim, which does not work very well today, to segregate them from the community. They don't get aliyahs, you can't buy in their store, you don't talk to them on the street, you don't invite them for Shabbos, don't make a phone call to them, to isolate them. So we do have an isolation technique, but it doesn't work well if we don't all
participate.
Yeah.
Don't they do that in the real Orthodox places like Williamsburg and Crown Heights with agunot, with the husbands that won't give the wives divorces? They can be put in chera.
Yeah, for sure. So, but still, they can leave.
Yeah, they can leave, but they are really ostracized by the whole community.
Yeah, much. Yes, they can be ostracized by the whole community, but they can just go to the next community. Or they can go to Israel. Mm. Or they can go to France.
It doesn't. Well, it may follow them.
It does a little bit, but not as much. It's not as powerful as before people were really mobile. I think it could be that social media makes it stronger today. You know, that we went through a weaker period until social media, because now you can just, like, things are all around the world. I mean, I saw one guy did give his wife a get because there was a social media campaign. You know, and everybody liked the page, and everybody started sending letters to the uncles and, you know, putting pressure on the place where they worked, and, you know, that there was social pressure that was bigger than that community. Because in that community, you can say, he's my nephew, I stand by him, I'll give him an aliyah in my shul. I don't think he's doing anything wrong.
Do you know what happened to that rabbi that was, I think he was taken to court, right, for organizing some physical...
Right, so that's the second way of making it work. You first ostracize, and if that doesn't work, we can bring a little more pressure, which is legal in the Jewish...
Right, right, but he was...
He was doing too much.
He was taken to the federal court or state court.
And he deserved it. I mean, he shouldn't have... Yeah, so we do have... Right, we do have a concept of we can beat him up.
But was he... Do you know if he was
convicted? I don't know what happened. I don't know what happened to him.
Interesting.
We do have, we can beat him up. However, and that is within halacha, we can put on that extra pressure in a halachic system that works. We don't now have a halachic system that's fully functioning. We do, unfortunately, have a lot of corruption. Among the corruption is, in a way, the fake using of this halachic pressure. So by fake, I mean unfair use. You are supposed to beat him until he says, okay, I'll give the get. But you're not supposed to charge the wife who wants to get out of the marriage $100,000 to get the thugs together. Yeah. You're not supposed to create extortion, and you're not supposed to beat him to real damage either.
I don't think he was doing that. I think he was just, getting some people to go on.
I heard about an extortion ring that was, I don't know, maybe it's two separate
maybe
things.
Maybe it's a different thing, because I remember there was on the NPR, actually, they had an interview with this, with one of the wives, and she was, like, in full support for this rabbi.
For sure. I can see that. Yeah, so I don't know what happened with that, to tell you the truth. It may be different cases, but there was recently an extortion ring where they were extorting money from the would-be divorcee, who's not yet, though, from the wife, to put the pressure on the husband to get right. That's not okay.
Yeah.
That's not okay, and that's outside of halacha. You know, and that's certainly outside of part of our halacha is dina de malchuta dina, is the law of the land is the law, when the law is fair and just, which it is here in this country. So let's say you're in Russia, where they say, you know, you're not permitted to buy food on the black market. You don't have to listen to that law, because you can't eat without buying food on the black market, you know, in a certain time. So even though that's the law of the land, halachically it does not apply, because you can't function with that law. But in this country, if they say the law is you have to pay income tax, that's the law. It's a fair income tax. It's not extortion. Everybody pays their fair share. It might be more than you feel like paying, but it's fair. And so that's the law. We're not allowed to get out of that in this country. So you're not allowed to just say, I can beat somebody. We have courts in this country. You are allowed to try to pass legislation, as there is in New York State. There's a get law that says you can't get your state divorce before you give your religious divorce. So that's how they've worked with it in New York State.
Must be the only state that has it.
I think it's the only state that has it. And I don't know if it helps or not, how that works all the way. I think some people just take off and they say, to heck with it. I don't care if you have your state divorce. I'm out of here and you're stuck. You know, and give me a call when you have that $150,000 and are willing to give me full custody of our children and sign on the dotted line that you'll never ask me for anything ever again, and then we'll discuss the get. You know, so there are people who do that. Real scumbags that do that kind of thing, unfortunately. So, anyway... how do we get into that digression? That's a sad thing. So we do have this concept that you can be safe if you're by mitzvah. So getting back to our mitzvah, you will be safe if you're in that city, and it's not an option. You have to go into that city. And we do want to try to protect the Kohen Gadol from negative prayers, because we do understand the effect of prayer And, you know, I don't know. It's possible that there have been people who are corrupt enough that they would send, you know, a relative. I could easily, you could see how, let's say, a man killed by mistake, a woman killed by mistake, she's in the city of refuge, and their spouse on the outside says, I got to get him back. We have a pack of little kids. We have a business to run. We have a family to, I miss her. I want her back. So I'm going to arrange to have the Kohen Gadol killed so she gets released. I could see that something like that could happen. You're right. That's a risk. Right? That's a risk. So we would have to figure out how to protect against something like that. Okay, so now let's read the. So he goes, or the person goes to that city alone. At the root of the precept lies the reason that the crime of killing is utmostly serious, for in it lies the kernel of destruction of the world, so much so that the sages of blessed memory taught that if a person kills someone deliberately, even if he has observed all the mitzvot, he is not saved from judgment. For it is stated, a man laden with any person's blood shall hasten his steps to the pit. None will support him. So there's nothing that can mitigate intentional murder. You know, that is, and because that does create the breakdown of society, but not just the breakdown of society that people are wantonly killed, which we see that kind of breakdown in Chicago, in Detroit, in places like that where there's wanton murder. Just like there isn't the respect for life, and then you can't count on anything, really. Like, how do you function in that kind of environment? So, but it's more than that. It's really the breakdown of our humanity, that we don't value the life of another person, that we would think, I want my wife back, and therefore I'll kill somebody else's husband who happens to be the Kohen Gadol. You know, like, that people can make those kinds of cheshbonot, those kinds of calculations, and that they do, really shows the breakdown of humanity and the lack of value of what life is. So we can't tolerate it in the least.
So I'm still wrestling with the idea. I'm sorry, just a short interruption. So if, you know, we're talking about how when the temple will stand again, there'll be more cities of refuge. How is it possible that there'll be murder?
Right, that's what I'm saying. That's what I find disturbing.
During the Mashiach
time. Yeah. I don't know. Death. Right. Well, death, I guess there will be death.
Well, but there could possibly be inadvertent, accidental death.
Yeah, but the inadvertent comes because there's
this calculation
problems.
Of killing somebody's, killing.
You know, like you said, that, you know, in the car that's sliding on the ice. And,
right.
You know, I mean, that's totally out of your hands in a sense.
Right. So if it's completely and totally out of your hands, I don't think you're held accountable for it at all. You don't have to go. It's for, I don't know, let's say it's 35 miles an hour, you were going 40 and it was the ice and you couldn't stop in time. Then it's not completely inadvertent. You know, then
there might still be incidents like that. I mean,
right.
So they have to prepare for
it,
I guess.
But there might be, right, but there might be. But the thing is, then what we see is that that person is considered culpable not because they killed on purpose, but because they were able to channel that person's death. So then they did. They are spiritually frayed enough at the edges that they were able to do that. How could it be during the times of Mashiach, when we have so much more clarity, that people will be in such bad shape that they're still killing inadvertently? That's my question. That's your question. How could it be? How could it be that we're going to need even more cities of refuge?
Well, it would mean that somebody has to die. And it would be channeled through this person
right.
who is not perfect.
Right.
I mean, there still has to be living and dying. I mean, there's not supposed to be any war.
Be
fighting.
I thought that there would be no dying.
But no, there won't be. We talked about that.
Okay,
life goes on.
Yeah, life does go on during the Mashiach era. After Mashiach era is different. Mm-hmm. But during the Mashiach era, life will continue largely as we know it, but with some changes. So I would like to see that be one of the changes. I find it frustrating to learn that there will be three more cities of refuge because we're going to need them. That's sad.
Because there was kind of a quote that I liked. I think it was Kafka who said that the Mashiach will come when he is no longer needed, but it sounds like he will be still needed.
Right. It could be like the police in our neighborhood and they come when they're no longer needed.
Yeah, he's 3 hours late. Oh. Crime.
Where is that killer? I guess he's gone. Hey, donuts, everyone. Okay. Is therefore proper for one who killed, even unintentionally, since such a great misfortune occurred by his hand, that he should suffer for it the anguish of exile, which is almost equal to the anguish of death. Since a man is then separated from his friends and his native ground, he lives all his days with strangers. Moreover, there is a rectification in the community through this precept, in the sense that the writ explains, for in this way he will be rescued from the hand of the blood avenger, that he should not kill him when there was no violence in his hands, since he had done it unintentionally. There is, too, a further benefit in the matter, that the kin of the victim should not see the manslayer before their eyes constantly, as the place where the evil accident occurred, for the ways of the Torah are pleasantness. So three things. One, something bad happened through his hands. He needs to suffer to expiate that. So he has to be separated from his family and friends and his native ground, and off he goes to the city of refuge. That will create the expiation that's necessary. I think from this we can also see part of the trauma of even moving today. Mm-hmm. You know, that is considered one of the big traumas, and we don't necessarily pay attention to it well enough. Like, we talk about losing a job, losing a parent, losing a sibling, but losing your city, even if you do it on purpose, you're moving for a job. It's a hard thing for people to be torn away. And so that's one of the things here. Second, though, is that by forcing him to go into the city, you save a life. You save the life of the killer. Because he could be killed. But why should he be killed? You know, he didn't do anything wrong, really, that he should be killed for it. So we want to save his life. So we force him into the city to save his life. But third, and it's a psychological thing here, we want to have a little rachmanis on the relatives of the dead person. They shouldn't have to see the one who killed him on a regular basis. Right. Get him out of the city. So they know they can go to the supermarket and not see him. They can go to shul and not see him. Not see the one who took the life of their beloved person. Mm-hmm. So those three reasons. Okay, and also, it has to be that the victim actually died from the incident. So let's say, you know, let's do the car hitting again. Let's say they lived in the hospital for, you know, they didn't die right from the strike of the car. But they did break their bones. Off they go to the hospital where they get MRSA and die. They did not die from being hit by the car. It did cause whatever, some disease. Oh. They get some bacterial infection from being in the hospital, right? They didn't die from being hit by the car. They wouldn't have died if they weren't hit by the car, because they wouldn't have been in the hospital. But they did not die from being hit by the car. And so, therefore, that person is not considered a shogeg killer. Mm. He damaged the person. He hurt the person, but he did not kill them. So then he does not have to go to the city of refuge.
But don't we have something in American law now where if you're not initially killed by the trauma, but you die later through pain and suffering or whatever, that it's still a crime against the one that did the damages to you? It just is even more? That it becomes manslaughter or something?
Yeah, so that's what lawyers say. If you hit somebody and you didn't kill them, back up and finish the job.
It's probably easier than going to court.
Because it's an easier trial and a smaller penalty for causing somebody's death than for causing their injury. Mm-hmm. That's just a lawyer
unintentional
joke.
Unintentional manslaughter.
Yeah. So, right, that's better than hurting somebody.
So they're all married to lawyers here.
Yeah. So, anyway, there probably is some law about that, but halachically, if that's not considered killing him, you're not then the shogeg killer that has to go to a city of refuge. It's a different crime. Let's see, and it goes into detail about that, but I don't know if we want to go into necessary detail about it. Let's see.
It says you can bring your teacher and bring your wife.
Okay, so that's what I want to...
Friends.
Yeah, let's look at that. Okay.
Yeah.
I do want to talk about bringing a teacher. Let's see. So there's a law about a woman, a male or female slave, who is exiled to a city of refuge if the husband or master is responsible for their sustenance there. So look, who's in charge? So, okay, so now you have somebody who's dependent on somebody else for their livelihood, who takes care of them in that city of refuge. So that's just a question. These are different questions that are discussed in the halacha. But let's just talk for a minute. Usually you're separated from your family, but let's just talk about the student or the rabbi. So a rabbinic student, a student of a rabbi, or a rabbi. One of them kills unintentionally. Off to the city of refuge they go, but so does their opposite one. If it's a rabbi, his students
their
go with
Heruta.
Him. Yeah.
Wow.
If it's a rabbi, the students go with him. If it's a student, the rabbi goes with him, and the whole yeshiva goes with him.
Really?
Wow.
Yeah. Because for somebody who loves learning and seeks wisdom, not being able to learn is like death. We're not killing the person. He's not supposed to be killed for his crime. So you don't have to send him to a place where his existence is like death. So therefore, he has to be sent with people who will keep him alive. So that's his chavrusa, or his rav, or his students. Isn't that something?
Yeah.
Because you can't
so
cause them
sent
to,
along with
they are
them.
Sent along. The whole one has to go.
Against their will, or they have to? They have
I think to they have to. Now, I think it's interesting. I mean, I wonder how that works exactly. I would imagine that one of things, because it certainly would be hard on the students, or on the rav, to go, right? Mm-hmm. They didn't. What did they do? Except maybe they did do something. I would venture to guess. Because if one from among them was able to channel the death of another, that shows a flaw in that person, which has to be borne a little bit by his community, by his close, especially spiritual seekers. Spiritual seekers that are not tending to the spiritual solidity of each member in the group, there is a level of responsibility. Just like we have the city of the Levi'im, which creates a collective kedusha that should be good for that person, so should a group of people who are learning together create some type of spiritual strength for one another that we help protect each other from these kinds of big mishaps.
Or a terrible spiritual deficit. I'm thinking of the 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva who were all killed in the plague, and he had to start all over again with his little shul, because his students were no longer worthy. They had done, was it Lashon Hora? Or
they didn't treat each other with respect.
Yeah, it was.
With adequate respect, whatever that means.
Yeah.
Right? So.
And that was really the sin of the first base midrash, the first temple.
It's the Mikdash. It was the second one.
I think it was after the destruction, the Rabbi Akiva.
Yeah, that's after the destruction. So she's just saying the same sin, but not treating each other with respect. So it's a scary thing to think about these 24,000 Talmudic students, right? Or they weren't Talmudic, but whatever. Holy students, learners, regular, full-time learners. Their crime was they didn't show enough respect for each other. Right? So that's not something we would be killed for if we show lack of respect. It's bad to show lack of respect. We're not on the level that would be judged for death for that. Yeah. So we have to know that the higher in levels we go of our learning, of our assimilation of mitzvot into our life, of the holiness that we attain, we're judged more harshly.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, I remember Rabbi Levi was talking about this in one of the classes on Monday nights. So his point was that these were the students who would eventually become the leaders and founders of the halacha, and they would have to debate on certain laws, and if they didn't show enough respect to each other, then they would never truth would never come out from their interaction.
That's good. I like that.
Right. It's fascinating just to think about what. So. Hashem's in charge of that, and it's just amazing to see how I could just say, you know what, you guys, I have to get you out of the way. Let me start with a fresh group and see if they work better. Yeah.
Sinat hinam, baseless hatred?
Yeah,
that
so...
That was the different... That was something else. That was the destruction of the... stealing was the first temple, right? The end of the first temple. And then the second...
Right, the second was the Sinat Chinam is the baseless hatred, right?
Baseless hatred.
But Rabbi Unger said to
is
me... He said he's never seen Sinat Chinam. We always think there's a reason for why we hate somebody else. It's not for nothing. Look how they dress. You know, look how little they give to the shul. Look how they're wanton with this or that. We always have a reason. There's no hatred for no reason.
But... You know, subjectively, yes, this person can justify his hatred or her hatred, But in reality, maybe nobody really understands the other person's.
That's what he said, is that really we should know that as justified as our hatred is, I just gave silly examples. Yeah, yeah. But let's say for a real one, right? Somebody treated you really poorly. And it was very clear that you never should have done it. But he said, in the end, you'll see that's not a reason to hate. You know, that as justified as you think you might be in really being angry with somebody, in the end, that's called sinat chinam, that it really is for nothing. That there's no, that there, what we think is justified reasons, because nobody thinks they're hating for nothing. Mm-hmm. So why call it sinat chinam, except for the fact that it is, that even justified hatred is really for naught, that there's no reason really for it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's something interesting to think about. Mm. Yeah. So, okay, so that brings us to the end. Let's just read this last paragraph. This precept is in effect at the time the Israelites are settled on their land, and the Sanhedrin of 71 meet in session at the place prepared for them in Jerusalem to judge capital cases. If a Beit Din of any locality transgressed this and did not exile an inadvertent killer to a city of refuge, the judges would thus disobey this positive precept, and their punishment would be very great, since it is a possible cause of bloodshed. And that is the end of this class for today. We'll continue this Rosh Hashanah next week.